From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. There are many ways to measure fame. One measure is whether you've been photographed by Annie Leibovitz. It was Leibovitz who photographed Demi Moore, pregnant and naked, for the cover of Vanity Fair. On this edition of Fresh Air, Annie Leibovitz talks about getting celebrities to pose in audacious ways. Also today, I talk with singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. He got his start in the folk rock band Fairport Convention. His rock still has the influence of traditional music of the British Isles. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new collection of Pauline Kael's movie reviews. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas faced questions today on some of the most basic issues that have been raised by his candidacy for the High Court. The controversial black conservative refused to say whether protections of privacy extended to abortion rights, but he told Senator Joseph Biden he believes the Constitution does uphold a right to privacy.
I think that, and I think the Supreme Court's rulings in the privacy area support that the notion of family is one of the most personal and most private relationships that we have in our country.
A number of senators questioned Thomas' views on so-called natural law, the concept that laws derive from an authority higher than the Constitution, such as God. Senator Orrin Hatch guided Thomas through a denial that he would apply any interpretations of natural law above the Constitution.
The natural law philosophy is a political theory. My interest was political theory. It was not constitutional law.
And so when you become a justice on the United States Supreme Court, and I believe you will, you intend to uphold the Constitution of the United States, is that correct?
With every fiber in my body.
Above anything else?
My job is to uphold the Constitution of the United States, not personal philosophy or political theories.
The Senate Judiciary Committee hearings will resume tomorrow. South African police have announced that armed plainclothes officers are traveling on trains from Johannesburg to Soweto in an effort to curb the renewed violence in the black township. The move came as the number of people killed since Sunday rose to at least 80. The BBC's Fergal Keane filed this report.
The violence of the past 24 hours has been sporadic, but no less fierce for that. At a taxi rank in Soweto, three women died when a group of gunmen opened fire at close range. The previous night, three other people were shot dead on a train travelling to Soweto. Meanwhile, some of those injured in the weekend clashes have died in hospital, with scores of others still being treated for stab and gunshot wounds. Soweto was calm today, though still considerably tense. Police and soldiers are patrolling the area in force, while a 9 p.m. to 5 a.m. curfew has been imposed in three of the most seriously affected townships east of Johannesburg. Soweto police have announced they'll be mounting train patrols by constables in plain clothes. Detectives investigating the attack in Tokoza, which sparked the violence, have issued an identikit photograph of one of the men identified by witnesses to the killings. A police spokesman said there'd been a spontaneous response to the appeal for information.
The BBC's Fergal Keane reporting. Stock prices closed sharply lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 25 points to end the day at 2,982.56. Declines led advances by a margin of 5-2 in moderate trading. This is NPR. Lithuania has proposed a working arrangement with Israel to prevent Nazi collaborators or war criminals from being exonerated. The Lithuanian government has been trying to rehabilitate people who were falsely convicted on war crimes charges by Soviet officials after World War II. There were reports in the American news media that the program has exonerated some who were involved in the murder of 200,000 Lithuanian Jews during the war. The Lithuanian government suggested that a joint working group from the Lithuanian and Israeli parliaments could investigate questionable cases. The Arab League Council has convened a meeting of foreign ministers in Cairo. The consequences of the Persian Gulf War dominated the fractious agenda. Lori Neff reports.
The regular Arab League Council session was opened by the League's new chairman, Lebanese Foreign Minister Ferez Buez. He called on council members to give up their quarreling in order to unite against Israel and further the Middle East peace process. However, the Kuwaiti foreign minister, the outgoing chairman, raised the subject of Iraq's invasion of his country, an issue which had sharply divided the League. He also spoke of the Emirates' recent allegations of an Iraqi military incursion on an offshore island. When Iraq's foreign minister attempted to respond, he was rebuffed. The session was then adjourned for 10 minutes and reconvened behind closed doors, where the Iraqi minister had reportedly been told he would be given a chance to speak. For National Public Radio, I'm Laurie Neff in Cairo.
Health authorities in California say that they found hundreds of migrant farm workers living in unsanitary camps and even caves in the Santa Clara and Salinas valleys. Officials said that most of the squatters were low-wage, undocumented Mexican farm workers who can't afford housing. A representative of the United Farm Workers Union said that officials have been looking the other way for years in farming areas all over the state. A spokesman for the California Farm Bureau said that that charge was untrue. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Few recent photographs have created the stir of the naked, pregnant Demi Moore on the cover of Vanity Fair. That's just one of the many provocative photos taken by my guest, Annie Leibovitz. She's famous for getting famous people to pose in audacious ways. There's a photo of an unclothed Bette Midler, covered only by dozens of roses. Leibovitz shot Roseanne Barr and her husband Tom Arnold mud wrestling in their bathing suits. She posed Whoopi Goldberg in a bathtub of milk. Leibovitz's gallery of celebrities also includes Michael Jackson, Meryl Streep, Susan Sontag, and Václav Havel. You've probably seen her portraits in Vanity Fair and in magazine ads for The Gap and American Express. For 13 years, she was with Rolling Stone and did some of their best-known covers. A retrospective of her work opens Friday at New York's International Center of Photography. And her photos are collected in a new book. On the cover is one of her most famous pictures, which originally appeared on the cover of Rolling Stone. It was taken just a couple of hours before John Lennon was murdered. He and Yoko Ono are posed in bed. John is naked, in a fetal position, curled around Yoko, who is fully clothed, in jeans and a sweater.
This is not anything new for the Lennons, really. They, they spent their career being photographed and televised from their bedroom, and from bed.
Their bed-ins.
Bed-ins, yes. And this was, I was asked to do the cover of John for Rolling Stone magazine, and John really felt that he wanted Yoko, there with him, that Yoko was part of him. And I really felt that this, they'd been together 10 years, and the story was that they had a rough time of it, and they were back together again, and they were more madly in love than ever. And I really wanted to photograph them in an embrace. And I had wanted to photograph them both nude. I mean, this was not, they also posed nude with the Two Virgins album cover. And at the last minute, Yoko decided that she didn't want to take her, she would take her shirt off, she wouldn't take her pants off. I said, well, why don't you leave everything on? And then it became this, very startling contrast of John, very naked and embryotic, curled up against Yoko, and very, very dark figure, sort of a mother-child relationship. But, it was funny, looking back over my 20 years of work, which is what this book is, I see that I was trying to take this kind of picture for some time. and John and Yoko became the solution to wanting to do this. I mean, wanting to show this embrace. I mean, he symbolized that whole era to me.
Your photos have gone over the years from the more candid kind of shot to the more posed kind of shot, a pose that almost symbolizes who the person is or who they represent. Can you talk a little bit about how you changed and why you changed?
Well, when I started, I came from a school of photography, of fine art photography, where my the people I admired were Robert Frank and Cartier-Bresson, and I really admired street photography. When I started to work for Rolling Stone, I was still going to school, and I sort of embodied this work into the Rolling Stone work, and it became a kind of journalism. And I found myself just photographing what I saw in front of me. As years evolved, and I kept working for Rolling Stone, I was doing the covers more and more, and the idea of people coming to me and being there for an hour and saying, okay, what do you want to do? You know, suddenly I was faced with the idea of, well, what am I supposed to do? I mean, not exactly that you had to make up life, but that I began to realize that the cover was a different situation than the inside work in the magazine, and that's how the portrait work really evolved, was really shooting for the cover of Rolling Stone. And I learned, I began to really enjoy that process of looking at a person for whatever time I was allowed to have, and sort of coming to a summation or a final photograph.
So what is the difference between a cover and what's inside?
Well, that's a good question today. It still evolves. I mean, in the 80s, early 80s, I really enjoy the more complicated conceptual covers, and I really had a great time with them, the Steve Martin cover and Bette Midler and the Roses. And it wasn't long before, magazine basically wanted to test what worked out there to sell. I mean, the cover really is used to sell the magazine, and it's unfortunate for me because I really enjoyed the more conceptual things. I thought that the conceptual covers did well, but it turned out that recognizability is still the main factor. And it's made me sort of not find the cover my most exciting assignment to do. I mean, I really love the inside work.
When you photograph an actor, an actress, someone who's really well known, mm-hmm. do they have approval of what photos get used? Do they ask to see them beforehand?
It happens sometimes. Tina Brown works really hard to fight things like this, but it does happen. But she more and more is putting her foot down and really trying to hold strong to it.
How do you feel about a person having photo approval?
Well, I think I work very differently. I really like to work with the person. And I'd say a good, 80 to 90% of my shootings, I like the person, and I like to have a collaboration because I feel like I get the most work, the best work from that. And I'm in trouble when you send me out to photograph someone really crafty because I don't want to, because I really do enjoy liking somebody.
How do you begin a shoot? What kind of work do you do as soon as you meet the person you're photographing?
Well,
or what kind of work do you do before you've even met them?
It's different. It depends on the time. I don't really go overboard, although it's one of the wonderful sidebars of my work is, for example, when I went to photograph Suzanne Farrell, the ballerina who's now retired. I ended up seeing the season at the New York City Ballet. It was, it was really great. Before I actually photographed her. Robert Penn Warren, I read all, his recent books of poetry. It depends, if it's an actor, I'll try to see his latest movie. Sometimes, I'll ask for all, it's easy now with the VCR to go home with, 8 or 9 videos and watch, watch everything they've done.
You have a beautiful, very elegant photograph of Ella Fitzgerald.
Mm.
And this is a photograph of her wearing a very beautifully tailored red suit. She's already lost a lot of weight from her recent illness.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really handsome photograph.
Is it the one in the book, or is it the American Express portrait?
The one in the book in a red suit.
Uh huh. Because the one in the book is an outtake from the American Express portrait campaign. But that was a wonderful day. I mean, that she had just gotten over a long illness, and she had lost a lot of weight. And that suit is her suit. It was in her closet, and we met with her a couple weeks before the shooting. And we had the suit taken in, so it fit her to the T. And that was one of these shootings where, you know, the journalism does fall by the wayside. There's no two ways about it. I mean, she was not in the best of health. She could barely stand up, and this was her first project she had done in several months. And, you know, the real photograph, you know, would have been astonishing to, you know, sort of see her, you know, in a corner, you know, barely being able to stand up. And I wanted her to be Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, I just wanted her, you know, to be, you know, as best, you know, as, I wanted her to be strong and great. And she got up and she became Ella Fitzgerald in front of my eyes. We, you know, she's just, that's one of those shootings where the experience was better than the photograph. The photograph is sort of the aftermath. It's, she was just so excited, and she felt great, and she, and you know, as soon as she got the clothes on, and she kept belting out, I'm bad," you know. I asked her to sing, and she kept screaming, I'm bad," you know. It's really amazing.
So it doesn't bother you that you're not shooting the person exactly as they are, that you're making them different from what they are, or, you know, more healthy than what they are.
Well,
what you want is to show your image of the person, or to show them at their best.
I guess the photographer has a lot of power, I mean, in that respect. I think people should be able to look as good, you know, or as great as they possibly can look. But I think it's about, I don't want it to seem a little corny, but there is an inner beauty involved, and if bringing that out is, I mean, I'm not, there, both those pictures are Ella Fitzgerald to me, her sitting there and, you know, in the corner, barely being able to stand up, and then standing up, you know, and looking like Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, they're both parts of her, and, you know, and I see it all the time, and you have so many different sides of a person to decide what, you know, what you're going to photograph. And you know, I'm definitely, I know I'm not doing journalism anymore. I'm doing editorial. I have an opinion, you know, and you know, it changes. It changes.
Let me ask you about a photo that's in a way the opposite of the Ella Fitzgerald photo. And I'm thinking of a photo that you took of Al Sharpton, mm-hmm. at the hairdresser's.
Mm-hmm.
And Sharpton, his head is all in rollers.
Mm-hmm.
And he's under the hairdryer. And he's wearing one of those schmatas that's supposed to protect your clothes from your hair, you know, as they're cutting your hair. And, I mean, who would want to get photographed with rollers under the hairdryer, let alone a man, right?
I don't think Al Sharpton would miss any opportunity.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's what he was thinking, you know. No, that came about because I had a session. We were set to meet, and then I got a call from his office, and they said, I'm sorry, but the Reverend will be an hour late. And I said, oh, really? I mean, can we push the shooting back? I said, oh, really? Why? What is the problem? He said, oh, he has to go to his hairdresser's. And I said, really? And I said, where is that? And then, you know, and they said, well, it's the Prima Donna Hair Salon I think it was Brooklyn. And I said, oh, would the Reverend mind if I met him there? And they said, no, absolutely not. And I arrived there and you know, it was right in front of me. I don't know. It's just, it was crying to be photographed, so I did.
He didn't mind? He didn't ask you to not shoot him then?
No, not at all. Actually, what the funny story about that photograph is that we were doing this for the Hall of Fame for Vanity Fair a couple of years ago, and, you know, I brought it in, and Tina was very, very excited about it, and when Sharpton realized that I was interested in it, and he saw that there was an interest in this facet of his life, he called up the New York Post photographer and had him come over the next day, and he repeated the same thing for him, and they ran it on the cover of the New York Post, and then Tina decided not to use the picture because it was already used. So the first time that you're seeing the picture is in the show in the book because, you know, Tina thought it, and I said, Tina, but this is a little better than the one that ran in the Post. And no, but the content was still there, and you know, he sort of, yes, Tina likes to use you know, likes to break the news. So,
do you have a different relationship now with the people who you photograph since you're so well known yourself? compared to when you started, when nobody knew who Annie Leibovitz was, but you were photographing people who were already pretty famous?
I don't really think so. I think things feel a little easier for some reason, but I find that people are willing to work harder for a photograph. Since what I've done is work and continue to work and that's my main interest. And the photograph is the most important result of our work together. I don't think things have changed that much. You know, I mean, it, as far as the relationship with the person that I'm photographing. I'm much more comfortable because I'm older, you know, and I've been doing it now for 20 years.
My guest is photographer Annie Leibovitz. You've seen her work in Vanity Fair, Rolling Stone, and in the ads for Gap and American Express. She has a new collection of photos called Annie Leibovitz, 1970 to 1990. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Photographer Annie Leibovitz is my guest. I want to talk with you about some of your early work in your early days at Rolling Stone magazine when you were photographing a lot of rock musicians. You've said that in those earlier days you had crushes on a lot of the musicians you had to photograph. Did that get in the way for you?
No, I enjoyed it. I mean, I was young. I was impressionable. You know, I'm a little older today, but if I got in the car with Bruce Springsteen, I'd still, you know, go, you know, my heart be beating a little faster. I mean, he's, you know, it's great to keep that, I think. You know, and when I was younger, there was more of a peer feeling, actually, especially in the San Francisco Bay Area. You know, I knew Jerry Garcia, and it was much more of a, friendlier time in a certain way. It's great. It's great if you're going to take someone's photograph part of the process is sort of being obsessed anyway, you know, so you might as well, you know, fall for it, hook, line, and sinker. I mean, it was fun to sort of have crushes I mean, I always kept the camera on, you know, and took photographs. But, you know, that certainly made the time go by faster, easier. And, you know, I enjoyed it. It was great.
Did you ever have to convince the musicians that you were there to be a professional and not a groupie, knowing how...
No, I was always a photographer. You know, that's what I was there to do. I mean, as I said, I started as a fine art photographer and... you know, I always felt that these people were walking through my photographs. I mean, I didn't feel the other way around. I mean, I said I appreciated and enjoyed, their music and enjoyed them as personalities. But that's as far as I went. I always knew I was a photographer, and that's what I was there to do, and that's what I really enjoyed to do. That was the most important thing to me.
When you were traveling with a rock musician on a tour, was there an understanding of what was going to be off limits to your camera? Would anybody like draw the line at the beginning of the tour and say, you could do this, but you can't photograph that?
You know, I didn't do that. I tell you what, I didn't do that much rock and roll. I actually, in 1975, when Mick Jagger asked me to be the tour photographer of the Rolling Stones and for their 75 tour, I actually left Rolling Stone for a few minutes and did the tour. And against Jan Winter's advice, he said, please don't do it. And I said, I have to go do it. And I traveled with this band of men for four or five months. And I did it. You know, I said, I'm not doing it again. You know, and I never really, you know, went back to it, you know, that seriously after that. I didn't really know how music was made until I traveled with that band.
Well, there's one photo, and I think this is from that tour, where Keith Moon is backstage with about six women who were in various states of mm-hmm. undress, and he's mm-hmm. got, you know, one hand on one woman and the other hand on another.
He was very theatrical. You know, it's very interesting, but I found out just recently in the last couple of years that he set up the photograph for me.
Oh, really?
That photograph was that he hired a bunch of girls. He knew I was coming.
You're kidding.
And that he waited till I walked backstage, and that, you know, they were these little trailers, and they just all undressed and did this thing. And then apparently I walked out of the trailer, and he paid the girls, and they all went home. I mean, I think it's very funny.
How do you feel about that?
I think it's great. It's great. It's great. I mean, he was Mr. Theater himself. I mean, he, you know, there you go.
To give a sense of how theatrical the photo is, I mean, it's not only like...
I mean, you think I set up pictures. I mean...
Right. These, you know, I mean, the couch was even propped up against the wall. That's how...
Oh, yeah. No, they made it look like a very wild scene.
Yeah.
No, I'm sure this is based on real life, but...
Right.
I'm sure it's based on real life.
Not the real thing, but a wonderful facsimile of it.
I'm sure it gets worse.
Right. Yeah. You photographed a lot of people who have a touch of exhibitionism in them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
it's tough, I tell you.
Yeah, I wonder if you feel you have any in yourself. And I feel, forgive me, I feel so kind of unprepared here.
I don't know if you hang around with these people long enough. It's, yeah, no.
I have read, and I should have seen this, but I just found out about it, and I haven't had time to try to get my hands on it. Mm-hmm. But I've heard that you photographed yourself topless for a recent Vanity Fair.
It's so funny. I don't think of it as topless.
I haven't seen it.
No,
so.
Actually, I've been asked over and over again, how would I take my self-portrait? And I promised Vanity Fair that I was going to try to do it. And I've been trying for the last, year to try to do it. And, I've always imagined the photograph being very, very stark and very, very simple. And it's that feeling you have when I almost want no ideas in it, that basically... You just come out of the shower and your hair's still wet, and you sort of look like an embryo or a frog or something, and that, you know, that was the start of it. But I can see that this self-portrait process is going to take, you know, a few years. I'm still too far away in that picture, and it's actually an interesting process, and I'm going to keep working on it for the next. Next, probably the rest of my life, but until I can come in close enough, even on myself. I mean, I'm still pretty far away in that picture.
And how do you feel about being that exposed yourself?
It's what I do. I mean, that's my work. That's my art. You know, that's I shouldn't be any less susceptible to it than anyone else.
Andy Leibovitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Annie Leibovitz's new book is called Annie Leibovitz Photographs, 1970 to 1990. A retrospective of her work opens Friday at the International Center of Photography in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. It's been too long since we took the time. No one's to blame. My no time flies so quickly.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Richard Thompson was the guitarist who rocked the British folk rock group Fairport Convention. But when he left the band, his music became more moody, more idiosyncratic. Coming up, we talk with Thompson about his recent album, Rumor and Sigh. Pauline Kael recently retired as film critic for The New Yorker magazine. Book critic John Leonard reviews Kael's new collection of movie reviews. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. On Capitol Hill, Judge Clarence Thomas sparred with members of the Senate Judiciary Committee on the opening day of hearings on his nomination to replace Justice Thurgood Marshall on the U.S. Supreme Court. NPR's Mara Liasson has more on the story.
Thomas's opening statement to the committee stressed his personal story, how he grew up in the segregated South, experiencing discrimination firsthand. He choked back tears as he described witnessing his grandfather's humiliation at being called boy, at seeing his grandmother denied the right to use a bathroom. The committee members said they were moved by that account, but they still pressed Thomas with their concerns about his judicial philosophy. They wanted to know whether his expressed admiration for the theory of natural law, the theory that there are higher laws that transcend the Constitution and Bill of Rights, would lead him to overturn Roe versus Wade. For his part, Thomas played down his adherence to natural law. He sidestepped questions about abortion. "I couldn't maintain my impartiality and comment on that," he told the committee. Thomas's testimony continues tomorrow. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Attorneys for confessed Israeli spy Jonathan J. Pollard argued before a federal appeals court today that he should be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. Pollard is serving a life sentence in solitary confinement in the maximum security federal prison in Marion, Illinois, 5 years after he pleaded guilty. He now says that the government broke its part of the plea agreement. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
A three-judge appeals panel in Washington heard Pollard's attorney, Theodore Olson, say that the government broke its promise not to ask for a life sentence. In failing to live up to its part of the agreement, Olson said the government had effectively asked for a life term. He pointed out that on the day of sentencing, then-Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger submitted an affidavit demanding the severest penalty for what he termed Pollard's treason. Assistant U.S. Attorney John Fisher agreed that the use of the word treason was regrettable since Pollard wasn't charged with treason, but he said the government had kept its part of the bargain. Pollard didn't have a very strong negotiating position and got the best deal he could, Fisher said, and he was now raising exaggerated claims years afterwards. A decision is not expected for several months. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
An official of the European Community says that the Soviet Union could run out of fuel this winter and that the West may have to help out. Stocks of oil have dwindled ahead of winter, leaving the world's top producer facing possible shortages as it tries to make changes in its economy. According to Soviet estimates, oil output fell 6% last year to 570 million tons, as is expected to drop to 540 million tons by 1995. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 24 points to close at 2,982.56. This is NPR News. Soviet leader Gorbachev, at the opening of the first human rights conference ever held in his country, said today that he would do all he could to end human rights violations and guarantee individual freedoms. The Soviet leader said that delegates to the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe had come to the capital of a thousand-year-old state, which is now entering a new period in its history. The Soviet president says that he sees a new voluntary union of independent states whose overriding values are freedom and dignity. Earlier this week, Iraq said it would not allow UN helicopters to survey its weapons sites. Now a report on a new ceasefire violation has surfaced. Linda Fasulo reports.
According to UN officials supervising Iraq's disarmament, vehicles used to tow missile launchers, partly dismantled under UN supervision, have now been patched back together. The officials say Iraq's explanation is that the reassembly was necessary in order to transport them, but they privately question that explanation and say it's up to the Security Council to issue tough warnings to Baghdad. A State Department spokesman said Iraq's refusal to accept the helicopter flights was a direct contravention of the Security Council resolution allowing the UN to do aerial surveys at any time. And he said Baghdad's defiance is clearly unacceptable. Soviet Ambassador Yuli Vorontsov said, if the government of Iraq is not going to cooperate, it will face serious consequences. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The government says that the U.S. had a foreign trade surplus of $3 billion in the second 3 months of the year, marking the first back-to-back quarterly surplus in 9 years. In the first quarter, the United States had a surplus of $10.5 billion. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the most important folk rock groups has been the British band Fairport Convention, founded in the late 60s. They started a new trend by playing traditional ballads from the British Isles on rock instruments and original rock songs influenced by traditional music. The person who was most credited with rocking this folk music was the guitarist Richard Thompson. He left the band for a solo career and performed with his wife Linda until they broke up in the early 80s. Richard Thompson is one of those great talents in music who never quite crosses over into the mainstream market, but many consider him among the best songwriters in rock and one of the most original guitarists. And on his new album, Rumor and Sigh, you can hear how expressive his singing is. This is a song about someone who's just gotten out of jail and feels so good he's going to take someone apart. It's called I Feel So Good.
Somebody's heart tonight. I feel so good. I'm gonna take someone apart tonight. They put me in jail for my deviant ways. 2 years, 7 months, and 16 days. Now I'm back on the street in a purple haze. I feel so good.
Richard Thompson, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
I think the song we've just heard, I Feel So Good, is, well, in its own way, deals with a kind of crisis that I think a lot of rock performers, rock songwriters get into in their late 30s or in their 40s. And that is when you're past the stage of youthful anger and rebellion, how do you capture the kind of energy, frustration, and passion that you want to put into music? And you've done that in this song by writing in persona.
Yeah, I think that is a good way of doing it. I've never really enjoyed, you know, that thing where you write about your own life. I've always found it a bit far too, you know, introspective. So it's interesting to use, you know, personas as a device and to use other characters as a way of expanding what you're able to write about.
How did you come up with this character?
I'm not very sure. It's a bit worrying, really, to think about it. It's a very worthless kind of character. You know, it's a fellow who's just come out of prison and he's not likable. If you make someone the subject of a song, you're almost suggesting that they're a hero, and this person definitely isn't a hero or even an anti-hero.
Now, writing songs in persona, writing stories about characters in songs, a lot of that was done in traditional English ballads, and that's the kind of music that's always influenced you. Do you feel that you've drawn on that in being confident in telling stories through songs or in describing characters in songs?
It's certainly a help to know the vocabulary, the vocabulary and the kind of imagery that's available from there is a wonderful jumping-off point to create something contemporary. There's something about the resonance of the language that gives you almost, you know, instant reference points and instant success in trying to do something new.
Now, a lot of the English ballads were stories of murder and death and jealousy and deviance and imprisonment.
Things haven't changed too much.
Right. Now, I want to play something else. This may or may not be a persona song. I mean, this is a song about being left by a lover, and there's, you know, This one could go either way. I don't know if this is autobiographical or not. Tell me something about writing the song.
Which song is this?
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood.
You have to tell me first.
That's right.
I misunderstood. You know, it's just a piece of imagination. I suppose it's based on, you know, a lot of common human experience. Everyone has felt like that, and everybody's has been dumped, and everyone's had a hard time with relationships. So, you know, it's just a love song.
Well, let's hear it.
Darling, I'm in love with your mind. The way you care for me, it's so kind. Love to see you again, I wish I had more time. She was laughing as she brushed my cheek. Why don't you call me angel, maybe next week. Promise now, cross your heart and hope to die.
Is the line, I thought she was saying good luck, but she was saying goodbye, is that the first thing that came to you in the song?
I'm not sure. I think the kind of guitar hooky riff was the first thing that I came to. I wrote it very quickly, so I'm not sure how things happened. Mm-hmm. I think also when you're writing, you're not really aware of what you're doing, which is kind of wonderful, really. It's like something else takes over and you're not responsible. So I'm really not responsible.
My guest is singer, songwriter, and guitarist Richard Thompson. His new album is Rumor and Sigh. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Thompson is my guest. Now, a lot of British rock performers were inspired by the British blues revival. What effect did that have on you?
I probably went the other way. I think I was slightly repulsed by the blues revival.
Repulsed?
Well, I've always, you know, since I was about 11 or 12, I was listening to the blues, you know. And when the blues revival came along, there was suddenly like thousands of British kids playing, you know, what were really inferior versions of Howlin' Wolf and B.B. King and Otis Rush. And I thought, well, this can't be right. You know, this isn't really any good. This is always going to be nothing more than a pale imitation of this wonderful music. You know, kids living in the suburbs of Manchester, England, are never really going to capture it. So I sort of went the other way, really. I think the blues revival and the popularity of soul music in Britain in the 60s really drove Fairport to traditional music, really, to an indigenous form of music.
So when you turned the other way and found music that was traditional in your country, the kind of folk ballads that you drew on, was that a return for you to that kind of music, or was that a brand new discovery of it?
It was a bit of both. I think what we knew about it, you know, sketchily, really. We'd always, you know, hung out in folk clubs and listened to traditional performers, and we had a bit of it in childhood, and they ram a bit of it down your throat at school, you know. But actually, to really understand it and get into it, we had to do quite a lot of research. We had to do a lot of learning. We had to spend a lot of time with traditional musicians to learn our stuff, really.
Why did you leave the band when you did?
I was writing a lot of songs that didn't seem to have any place in the band. It was very difficult for me to take those songs because they seem really rather eccentric songs, rather bizarre songs. But
like Henry the Human Fly?
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that ended up on Henry the Human Fly, you know, which is a very eccentric album. And but it was a direction that I really wanted to explore, and it seemed it'd be better. I'd have more time to work on it. If I was outside of the band, you know, I was reluctant to leave because they were all great friends, and we still are great friends. But you know, bands have to change.
For many years after the Fairport period, you performed and recorded with your wife, Linda Thompson. And I think a lot of people assumed that the songs that you were singing were personal songs about your relationship together. I'm wondering if that is something you feel like you would never want to do again. In other words, to really sing with someone who you had that close a relationship and to sing songs about a relationship together.
First of all, I'd say that the songs really weren't about a relationship, whatever people might think. you know, again, the songs were fiction. What was going on in the subconscious? I mean, I don't know, but there's nothing deliberately written about, you know, people. Obviously, if you're writing for a man's voice and a woman's voice, you have to write songs from a woman's point of view. So, if you're writing about relationships, then you know you have her angle, then you have his angle, and it almost looks as if you're writing a kind of soap opera. What would I like to do it again? Very hard thing to do. I wouldn't want to do it again.
Yeah. After you had broken up, you were still committed to a tour that you were scheduled for. So you were performing on stage after the breakup, and from what I know, it was a very rough tour for you. What was that like?
very rough. It was a difficult thing to do. We shouldn't actually have done it. I think it was unfair on both of us and on the band and on everyone concerned. I suppose audiences got some kind of a frisson from watching, maybe. But I think it was just a little too gory, really.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Thompson. You became a Sufi Muslim. Do I have that right?
Just Muslim would be a more accurate description.
Oh, okay. And how did you first become a Muslim? When was it, and what led you in that direction?
I had some musician friends who were Muslims, and I was very impressed by them as people. You know, I really liked whatever quality they had, which is, I suppose, kind of indefinable. You know, that they had a certain kind of nature about them, certainly kind of a way of carrying themselves that I was very impressed with, and I wanted to be like them.
Some people might find it paradoxical that years after becoming more spiritual, you're writing these really dark songs. Do you find any irony in that, or does that make perfect sense to you?
Not really, no. You know, I might have spiritual aspirations. I mean, again, you know, I hate to, you know, to publicize, you know, this aspect of me. You know, it's kind of, you know, the private side of a human being. I'm a rock and roll musician, and you know, I'm full of, you know, doubts and worries and all this kind of stuff. You know, all this being a human being business, you know, gets expressed in the music. And also, I try and express what I see around me. And it's a difficult age for people, you know. It's an age of real frustration for people, real disappointment for people. You know, there's terrible things going on, and I think I really have to write about that.
Is rock and roll accepted in Islam?
Is Islam accepted in rock and roll? Is it accepted? That's a good question. I think we might need about 4 hours to answer that one. It's a difficult question.
Well, let me get back to your new record, Rumor and Sigh, and play another song from it. And this is called God Loves a Drunk. It's a terrific song. Would you say something about writing it?
Yeah. I've never really equated spirituality with being sober. You know, I never liked those sort of TV evangelist types. You know, or the chaps who come and knock on your door, and they're all very neat and clean. They've got sort of polyester suits on and these very tidy haircuts, and they're very clean shaven and well presented. You know, I don't like all that. You know, I really don't like it. The people I think of as being spiritual that I've ever met in my life have actually been rather wild and outrageous almost, and they couldn't care less about what people think of them or what they look like they don't care about what they possess and all that kind of stuff. And I think that's really what the song's about. You know, the drunk is in a sense much freer and wilder than the rest of society.
Well, let's hear your song, God Loves a Drunk.
Will there be any bartenders up there in heaven? Will the pubs never close? Will the glass never drain? No more DTs, no shakes and no horrors. The very next morning you feel right as rain. Cause God loves a drunk, lowest of men, like the dogs in the street and the pigs in the pen.
That's Richard Thompson from his new album, Rumor and Sigh. This is a real, instrumentally, it's a real basic, like, man and his guitar kind of song. Do you like to occasionally, there's some really interesting production on this new record, but this is like an example of the record at its sparest. Mm-hmm. Do you like to save room in your repertoire for that kind of spare work?
I think so. I think it's very powerful to strip things down and be direct. I do a lot of acoustic shows, when I'm not working with a band, and you can certainly put lyrics across to people very, very strongly with just man and guitar.
Richard Thompson's new album is Rumor and Sigh. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering this first day of the Clarence Thomas hearings?
Well, while Nina Totenberg and Paul Duke do the live on-air coverage, Mara Liasson's going to be doing our story on today's hearings, in which the members of the committee made their opening statements, then Judge Thomas made his, and then the questioning began. We'll also hear from Professor Walter Dellinger of Duke University Law School about what the appropriate bounds for questioning a Supreme Court nominee have been historically and what they should be in his view. Also, news of Macedonia's declaration of independence from Yugoslavia and the danger of lead in wine.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. After 24 years as film critic at The New Yorker, Pauline Kael recently retired. Some of her most careful readers have been fellow critics. Our book critic John Leonard is no exception. He has a review of her new collection, Movie Love, Complete Reviews 1988 to 1991.
Movie Love is the last of 10 collections of Pauline Kael's caustic, canny, cranky, in-your-face, below-the-belt, know-it-all, warrior-woman film reviews. Among the movies she likes too much are Casualties of War and The Fabulous Baker Boys. Among the movies she doesn't like enough are Born on the 4th of July and Dancing with Wolves. She's right about Batman, though she might have noticed that Jack Nicholson was impersonating Richard Nixon. Well, I've been reading Kael for 3 decades. I stopped entirely trusting her in 1972, after she made me go see Last Tango in Paris. I stopped speaking to her a couple of years after that, when she left New York for the North Woods. But how dare she quit on us? Didn't Picasso go on doodling into his 90s? Without these hungry minotaurs, in their labyrinths, to whom shall we feed the yearly crop of virgins? It's not the first time she's quit on me, and a lot of good it did her. Back in Berkeley in the early 60s, I was in charge of drama and literature programming at the Pacifica radio station. Cale reviewed movies for us. When I slotted her for 15 minutes, she took 30. When I scheduled her for 30, she took 45. When I complained, she quit on me, on the air. To our vast audience in the Bay Area, she said, "After a million words for love, I'm going to start doing it for money." For money, Cale started doing it at McCall's. They fired her after she panned The Sound of Music, calling Julie Andrews super goody two-shoes. At Life, before it died for people's sins, they wouldn't publish her classic account of the making of the movie version of the group. At the New Republic, readers were outraged by her savaging of Antonioni's blow-up. That left The New Yorker. On William Shawn's radio, she could talk all night. And it didn't matter whether you agreed with her. On Ingmar Bergman, for instance, the Billy Graham of the post-analytic set. Or Dirty Harry, is this the last outpost for the Western hero, killing homosexuals to purify the cities? It was enough that she took her wit and intelligence with her, into the cave of what she calls this bastard cross-fertilized super art. That she sought a vision, a white whale like Moby Dick, but that she'd settle for style, audacity, or craziness, those moments of pleasure that are cleansing or subversive. She's seen it all. She forgets none of it. This makes for an awesome, if somehow casual, authority. For example, she has written, "I don't think there has ever been a good kidnapping for ransom movie. I don't know why, any more than I know why when opera singers go into the movies, the baritones can act, but the tenors can't." Is this true? Who cares? Wilford Sheed has described movies not as Moby Dick, but as a fur-bearing, duck-billed moneymaker, which occasionally stumbles into art and out again as if it were Mr. Magoo. About this creature, you could talk to Pauline Kael. So she was wrong about Last Tango. She was right about Nashville and the Warriors. I rose to her defense when Renata Adler attacked her in the New York Review of Books. I attacked her myself when she misread Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being. But it never occurred to me until now that I'd have to go to a movie without her.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Pauline Kael's new book, Movie Love, Complete Reviews, 1988 to 1991. Fresh Air's reviews and interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shurrock, Sue Weinstein, and Robbie Harris. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Shelby Steele discusses what he thinks is perhaps the greatest obstacle that African Americans face today, their focus on their own victimization. Steele is the author of the controversial bestseller, The Content of Our Character, A New Vision of Race in America. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.